I am pleased to welcome to public radio station WBGO one of the faces of public television today, Emmy and Peabody Award recipient and PBS NewsHour co-host Amna Nawaz. In the tri-state area, PBS NewsHour can be seen nightly on WLIW and WNET, which means I get to watch you twice at 6 p.m. and 7 p.m. every weeknight. The show has been on the air nightly on weekdays since 1975. Previous hosts have included Robin McNeil, Jim Lehrer, Gwen Ifill, and Judy Woodruff. Since January 2023, the show has been co-hosted by Amna Nawaz and my Morehouse College brother, Jeff Bennett. In my research for this interview, I learned that at one point early in life, Amna wanted to become a lawyer, but decided to become a journalist instead. Amna, thank you for being here. I should note this interview was pre-recorded on January 6th, 2026. So let me start with this. In the age of highly partisan media and social media, Amna, how would you describe the mission of PBS NewsHour and PBS generally?
First of all, let me just say thank you so much for having me. I've always loved speaking with you. Usually this is flipped around. It's me asking you questions
Right.
and learning from you. So this is a little uncomfortable for me, but I will settle in and be just fine. So the mission, as you know, as listeners of WBGO well know, has always been to provide news, information, and analysis for the public interest, for the American people. It is about as simple as it gets. It's about as closely tacked to our core journalistic mission as anything ever has been. And public media writ large, I mean, for folks who grew up on it, as I did, as my kids did, it's really sort of an integral embedded part of who we are as Americans from childhood all the way up through the rest of your life, right? I grew up watching Mr. Rogers. My kids grew up watching Daniel Tiger and Sesame Street. And now I get to co-anchor the PBS NewsHour, which is the flagship news broadcast of public media. And I believe one of the only national broadcasts that actually appears across every single member station, of which there are more than 330 across the country. And I always like to point that out because folks, I think, forget how deeply embedded public television in particular and public radio are into American communities, rural, urban, and suburban. And so the mission has always just been that, you know, since the 1960s, when the Public Broadcasting Act was put into place in the Johnson administration, it was the idea that there should be information, news, and analysis provided free of corporate interference or influence or governance that is just in the public's interest. And that has been the backbone of everything we do.
So how do you describe the objectivity you bring, free of political or partisan influence? And how do you ensure that the content basically plays it straight?
Yeah, I think as a journalist, regardless of whether I was reporting for commercial outlets, which is where I got my start, I was at NBC News early in my career as a foreign correspondent. I was at ABC News as an anchor and correspondent, and now I'm at PBS. But the core journalistic mission is always to let the facts lead, to report without fear or favor, right? You set your own personal biases aside, and everyone has them, and you let the facts lead you across the story. You try to provide nuance, you try to provide all sides of a story, and every day you wake up and you try again a little harder. And that is the goal. And journalism is a practice. I'll be the first to admit it is not a science. It's not perfect every time. Stories evolve as we report on them. Our reporting evolves as we continue to follow stories. But the core idea is you follow the facts wherever they lead you. And I think at PBS in particular, the NewsHour especially, it's always been so deeply embedded in our DNA that that has been the way that it is because we are funded by the public. We don't exist if our viewers don't support us, if our taxpayers don't support us.
Sounds familiar.
Right?
Same is true of this radio station.
Exactly. And so I think that lends itself to a greater connection, like a deeper sense of accountability. We certainly feel it in the way that we get feedback from people. I get a ton of messages and emails and regular comments on The smallest of things, from times when I make a grammar mistake in the broadcast, all the way up to, I really don't think you should have interviewed that person, to maybe you should interview this person or do more of this story or less of that. We have a deeply engaged, highly interested and issue-driven sort of base and viewership. And so I think in terms of a bias, and I know we'll get to a lot of this in the conversation, the core mission is always, we are not right, we are not left, we are wherever the facts lead us. These days, it feels like everything has become politicized. And so, regardless of where the facts lead, it's very easy. And I think often is the case that one side or the other will say, well, that's the liberal side, so this must be a liberal argument they're making, or sometimes to say, well, that's the conservative side, so this must be a conservative side they're making. But sometimes that's just where the facts lead us. And so my guiding principle has always been, it is not my job to tell you what to believe or what to think, but it is my job to make you want to think about these things.
I'm 68 years old. I grew up watching ABC or NBC or CBS Nightly News, listening to my local AM radio station, or waiting for the newspaper to show up in the mailbox. And to the extent I was interested in anything beyond the baseball scores, that's how I got my news. That's how my parents got my new their news. That's how we got our news about the Vietnam War, about who's running for president, and all the major national events of the day in the 60s, 70s, 80s. Now, as you know better than I do, so many Americans turn on their television because they want to hear and see somebody who agrees with them. They want to be angry at somebody and they want validation for their anger. How do you cast your appeal to your viewers such that they're interested in the information and not interested in necessarily having their opinions validated or their biases validated?
I think you're absolutely right that we live in a time when it is so easy to give in to what is a very basic human emotion, right? We all want to be right. We all want to be comfortable. And when you can rely on sources of news and information that reflect back to you things you already believe to be true or want to be true, it's a lot easier to continue to get your information from them and rely on them. And then we move into these sort of information bubbles. And we're all living in our own little information ecosystems that often aren't even having the same conversation or looking at the same stories, much less listening to people they disagree with or hearing from sides that oppose or challenge their views. I mean, there's a reason that rage bait was the Merriam-Webster word of the year last year. And it's because a lot of the information that gains traction online, and a lot of our content lives online. I mean, this is where most people get their information, right? The linear television broadcast is declining, and that's why we are everywhere. Most people will, if they don't watch us on the broadcast, they're streaming us on YouTube or they're watching our clips on social media or other places online. And things and information and stories that make you feel a certain way, right? That make you angry, that make you want to act, that get your sort of adrenaline going. Those are really easy to engage with and then amplify. And that's the stuff that ends up kind of making its way across the information sphere really, really quickly. One of the things I'm most proud of that we do at NewsHour is try to take a deep breath and try to calmly deliver information to people. Take the emotion out of it where possible and just let the facts tell the story. We have the benefit, I will say, which is something I didn't and I wasn't able to say at NBC or ABC, where we have an hour commercial-free every single day, which is like an unheard of blessing in broadcast television because we can
And 30-minute
take.
news shows move really fast.
And 30-minute news shows on a commercial network, you factor in the commercials, you're talking about maybe 22 minutes of content, right? And if there were five big stories that day, you're maybe getting 2 minutes on each story. Like you can understand what happened, but it doesn't necessarily explain to you why it matters or give you the appropriate context. I think that's why people come to us. We're going to take the time to let you hear from people who disagree on this topic. We still host debates regularly. Like, where do you see that? You have a person on one side of the issue and a person on the other who will just talk it out, hopefully civilly, for, 8, 9, 10 minutes. And I think there's value in that. It is uncomfortable. Let's be clear, it's really uncomfortable to have to listen to someone who challenges things that you hold dear, especially if they're things that are really core to who you are as an American or at, in whatever part of identity you put forward. But it is central to understanding our country, our world, and everything around us.
Right. So you just touched on something I wanted to ask you about, debate. You have Brooks and Capehart every Friday. That's a very between the two of those particular people, it's a very civil discussion.
It is.
I'm gonna, and this is not a political question, it's not political commentary, but my educated speculation is that when the incumbent administration does something controversial, it's probably way easier for you to recruit a guest to come on to criticize what they've done as opposed to an administration official to come on to defend the controversial action. Is that a true statement?
I think just by looking at the TV landscape, where you see administration officials popping up most frequently, that is absolutely supported by the data. Yeah. They're not anxious to have to come out to explain the statements or the actions of the president. I
Right.
think that's fair to say. Yeah.
Right. And how often is it the case that you are able to get, a one versus one debate around a policy issue beyond Capehart and Brooks? How often does that happen?
It
Like a
probably
conservative
happens
law
more,
professor versus a progressive law
I
professor.
will say, more frequently than most people might expect. And here's why. One, we have the benefit of being in Washington, which is an incredibly ideologically diverse place in terms of people who've been in government before, are now out of government, or are working to get back in or work adjacent to it. There's a lot of people with a lot of different ideas about a lot of big topics in this city. And so we recently actually launched a new series called On Democracy, which was taking a step back from the daily headlines and saying all of these big things that we're talking about, the rule of law, the limits of executive power, autocracy versus democracy, how do we talk about these things in a smart way and present different viewpoints? And we will literally have a constitutional lawyer who believes that executive power is pretty much limitless. It's whatever the executive decides it should be. And someone else who says, no, here's the precedent, here's what we've done in the past, here's why it's dangerous for executives to have that kind of unlimited power. And we'll have a 10-minute conversation with each of them separately. One night we'll air one night we'll air another. And we've done this with a lot of different topics. And actually, we just won a Cronkite Award for that series. So I know that it resonates and people have found it powerful. I think being able to have those conversations allows people to have information, hear from both sides, and then make up your own mind about how you
Right.
feel about this, right?
Right.
And so
Or
that isn't quite,
you hear a divergent point of view, and your own point of view is strengthened because you've heard the counterargument and you
Correct.
understand the counterargument and you know why you disagree with it.
That's right. But we also, to your question, we hosted, I think the last real debate we hosted was not too long ago, and it had to do with people who disagreed on the president's Venezuela boat strike policy. This was before the Maduro capture. And it was someone from the conservative side of the political and foreign policy spectrum who said, this is absolutely within the president's power. These strikes are legal. This is what the president needs to be able to do in the interest of our national security. And someone who said, this is an illegitimate use of executive power, and they need congressional authority, and there's concerns here. And that was a real back and forth. They disagreed about the actions that the administration was taking.
How often are you able to get existing office holders to have that kind of debate, like existing members of Congress?
I will say existing sitting lawmakers and administration officials will rarely, if ever, engage in that kind of on-camera
Right,
debate. They
right.
will often agree to appear back to back, so in a one-on-one interview before or after the other person, but we haven't had anyone come on for a debate,
Right. They're
which is
afraid
a
of
shame.
losing. They're afraid of looking bad.
I guess so. Also, it's just, I think if they want a chance to present their side of the story, and everyone Democrat or Republican wants to get their message out, right? And so they'd rather just have to do it with the interviewer rather than debating someone across the aisle.
Right, and far too often they'd rather just have an audience that they know is already going to agree with them too,
That too.
which is your
That too.
challenge.
It is our challenge. And I will say, too, a lot of times we get feedback from people saying, why didn't you have someone from the administration on? Why haven't you had a Republican on this issue? And I have to make clear it is not for lack of trying. We
Right.
regularly, I would say 4 out of 5 days of the week, are putting in requests to the White House, to various lawmakers to come on the show. We've had actually a lot of Republican lawmakers recently, probably more Republicans than Democrats on the show in the last few months. And, it kind of just it tips based on what's happening in the news cycle, based on who's in power, all of those things.
So, the right in Washington criticizes PBS as being an agent of the left. PBS NewsHour is an agent of the left. How do you combat that, and how do you think that label gained any kind of currency?
I think it has been, first of all, it's a pretty lazy argument, and it's kind of a broad strike against all what we'll call mainstream media. This is something we hear a lot over the last several years about the woke, liberal, mainstream media that's dominated by coastal elites. It's an easy way, I think, to undermine the credibility of some of the largest outlets for news and information in the country, and it serves the people who we report on, right? Who would rather we don't report some of the stories that we do or say some of the things that we say. And I think that's really important to put out there. Like that's who benefits from undermining the credibility of news organizations. I don't think that we try to combat that because I think, as you mentioned earlier, the show that I co-anchor has been around for 50 years and it has consistently been rated the most credible news outlet across all other news outlets when these kinds of things are polled. And the one thing we don't get to say often enough is that our audience, when we've gone out to them and surveyed to see who exactly is watching, actually self-identifies as a third conservative, a third liberal, and a third independent. And I don't know of any other national news outlet that can say that. So I think that alone speaks to the kind of people who are drawn and who engage with us. And I will say, for all the kind of broad attacks against what we do and the stories that we cover and how we cover them, an anecdote, the plural of anecdote is not data, I know, but anecdotally, when I've talked to people who will say, why are you so liberal? Why do you cover these issues? And I'll ask, have you ever watched the show? And the answer is usually no. And when they do, 9 times out of 10, what I hear is, oh, actually, it wasn't at all what I thought it would be. And I thought you did a pretty good job giving this guy a hard time one day and this guy a hard time the next day. And you covered this issue with representing all sides of it. And I take great pride in that when people will say, okay, I did watch. And I agree that you do really try to play it straight.
I'm guessing that there's a challenge reaching my kids' age, early 30s, 25 to 35, which in my judgment is vital for news shows like yours. How do you try to address that?
So first, I'll say it's a challenge for everyone, right? And as I mentioned before, linear broadcast audiences, so like people who sit back on their couch and, turn on a big screen and use the remote control to switch channels and stuff, that audience is dwindling. I'm part of that dwindling audience. We cut the cord years ago, right? I don't watch anything on live television except for some news, and we stream that through apps or sports. And again, we stream that through apps. So I totally get it. My children don't know what a commercial is. They've only ever watched content when they can scroll through 10 seconds ahead to get to the good part of the show. So it's a challenge. I'll also say something I learned from my husband, who worked in this industry with a lot of audience engagement and like digital innovation side stuff, was when they asked people, where do you get your news from? Just trying to kind of figure out where are people going for this stuff. I think they were looking for answers that were like, oh, I go on social media, or oh, I watch television, oh, I go to this channel or this person. And the number one answer they got was from my phone. Meaning people are kind of outlet agnostic. It doesn't matter if it's coming from a certain person or from a certain place. They care that the little computer in their pocket is the place that it can come to. And so I think for us, the challenge has just been the same thing that a lot of other legacy networks are dealing with, which is how do we make sure our work is showing up in the same places that people already are? And we already know the majority of Americans are getting their information and news from social media. So we are on Instagram, we are on TikTok, we are on Facebook. We make sure our good work and the good information gets out there to hopefully combat some of the bad.
You know, a couple of years ago on this show, I had as one of my guests Rob Reiner.
Yes.
And he made the very interesting point that All in the Family was iconic. It was a big hit. You watched it on Saturday nights at 8 p.m. And when 40 million people watched it, they all watched it at the exact same time.
Yeah.
So they all saw the same thing at the same time in the same place from the same type of device. And I'm sure that that in and of itself creates its own sort of dynamic for people, you know, growing up as I did in my generation.
Yeah.
So, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has been defunded by Congress. Its board of directors has voted to shut it down. What challenge does that present for PBS NewsHour?
Several. I will say this takes a little bit of explanation because I think even it took me a while to understand fully how the wheels of public media turn. Can I say one thing about what you said about Rob Reiner, though?
Sure,
Because
please.
the All in the Family viewership numbers, when you see them, they're so striking today because nobody gets those numbers today. And I think one of the things we don't talk enough about was we lived in a time, you lived in a time then when there were absolutely shared national experiences, right?
Exactly.
We don't have those anymore. And I think if there's one thing that contributes to this stratification and the tribalization and everyone sort of living in their own little ecosystems of information, it is that. It's one of the things that troubles me most is that even in moments of shared national concern or tragedy or crisis, like the pandemic, there aren't enough things pulling us together. And one of the reasons that I hold fast to this idea that, central news that's purely fact driven, that does this work without fear or favor, just relentlessly every day, is that when something big happens, I feel like people still need a place that they feel like they can turn to. And one of the reasons I fight so hard to maintain this broadcast to make sure that it perseveres, it was here long before I was born, it will be here long after I am gone, I will make sure of that, is because I think people need a place to come. I just wanted to say that because I think that 40 million people in America don't do anything together anymore,
Correct. Right. Except maybe watch the Super Bowl. Right.
except Super Bowl, correct.
Right.
And even then, the halftime show was a big controversy. So let's not talk about that.
Right.
The Corporation for Public Broadcasting was established back when the Public Broadcasting Act was put into place, basically as sort of a mediator body. So Congress appropriates the funds, they go to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and CPB would distribute those funds to PBS stations and NPR stations across the country. That's generally sort of how it worked. When the president asked, and Republicans in Congress obliged to rescind public media funds to the tune of about $1 billion, that included foreign funding as well, that money went away. And public media has always been funding sort of 2 years in advance. It was one of the things put into place to sort of guard it against political winds blowing one way or the other, or a certain party coming in or out of power every couple of years too. So that is gone. The Corporation Public Broadcasting unwinding itself was sort of the last step in that rescission, which is just that the body can't exist. There's no more federal funding coming through it. It doesn't have a purpose. It can't sustain itself. It's, I think, in the process of sunsetting all the funds, and then it will shut down. Where that leaves the more than 300 PBS member stations across the country, the many more NPR stations across the country, depends on where you are. There are some places where, there's enough of a donor base, there's enough foundations based there's enough wealthy people, corporations, they can try to fill in some of that funding gap. But there's a lot more places where that is just not possible.
Right,
We've
right.
already heard about a station in Western Pennsylvania, in Alaska, in Alabama, a lot of places for whom Those funding cuts are existential, and that's really concerning for how people in those areas are just getting their news and information.
So some local news stations are more were more dependent on federal funding than others.
There was an example in Alaska, I remember, which was one of the few places that actually broadcast in both English and the local indigenous Kupik language, I think, which was like the most commonly spoken indigenous language in Alaska, I believe, where every year from their donor base, we all fundraise, right? You guys know about fundraising from your viewers and listeners. Every year they would raise about $50,000. The federal funding was closer to $1 million every year.
Right.
That's what kept them going, right? And it's not just, programming and news and information and stuff. It's like emergency broadcast system. It's, there's a storm coming, you need to evacuate. It is, there's a national emergency, here's what you need to know. It's that level of information that's just not getting out now.
Right. So how about PBS NewsHour itself? How dependent have you been on federal funding, and should I worry about your future? I hope not.
Well, I'm not going to say you shouldn't worry because I don't want everyone to think it's all okay. It's not. We took a hit. Everyone took a hit. And we are asking our donors and supporters and viewers to step up. People can donate directly to PBS NewsHour as well, straight through the website. We are produced by WETA. That's the local PBS member station here in the DC
Right.
area that we rely on. And so that people can donate to their own local member stations too.
By the
But
way, are you still based in that? You're still based in that small shop in Northern Virginia?
we are in Northern Virginia in Shirlington. We moved basically down the street to another building that was a little more updated. We have a
Okay,
brand new
all right,
studio
all
we
right.
unveiled last year. So not the same place I think you were last in. You got to come by the new place too.
Okay.
It's not great, I will say. We need all the help
Yeah.
we can get. We're also in a time of great need across all different kinds of organizations that have relied on not just federal funding, but grants from foundations and corporations and that kind of thing, which are all drying up in recent years. So,
Right.
I would encourage people, if public media is something that's important to you, now is the time to do something about it.
And last question, why is it important to keep PBS NewsHour on the air? I'm asking the obvious, but I think our listeners need to hear this maybe two or three times. Why is it important to keep you on the air?
I'll say this. You mentioned earlier, I thought I was going to be a lawyer when I was coming out of school, mainly because I had no idea what I wanted to do. And everyone always said, you would make a great lawyer. And so I thought I would do that. I graduated from college in 2001, and I took a 1-year internship that I thought would just kind of fill the gap because I didn't want to go straight to law school coming out of undergrad. And that internship happened to be at ABC News Nightline under Ted Koppel when he was anchoring. And I started that job in August of 2001. And 3 weeks into my very first job out in the real world as an adult trying to find herself, her place in the world, the 9/11 attacks happened. And the entire world changed and my place in it changed. And I saw the absolute best in the business come together and do what they did best. And they put straight information out into the world. And they tried to fill the enormous voids that were created by all the fear and uncertainty with actual facts and information. And they gave people a place to come to try to feel better about what was going on, to try to feel like we're gonna make it through this together. That was my very first big story I ever covered. And I have carried that ethos through my entire career, that these kinds of organizations, journalists who are committed to leading with the facts, and they exist at every news outlet, I should say, but PBS NewsHour in particular for 50 years has been working this way. And I firmly believe, if you believe in democracy, if you believe in an informed and empowered electorate, you also have to believe in good, free, and fair journalism.
Okay. Amna Nawaz, thank you for joining my show, All Things Seoul, on public radio station WBGO, and thank you for your time.
Jay, thank you so much for having me. Always great to speak with you.